Accession number 106141.
Mr. John March, Reel 1. Could you tell me when and where you were born, Mr. March?
I was born at Wylam on Tyne, at a place called Rift Farm, overlooking the River Tyne, and very near to that famous Northumbrian, George Stephenson, who was responsible for one of the railway engines, one of the first railway engines.
What was your date of birth?
1st of November, 1911.
What was your father's profession?
My father was an auctioneer and valuer. His main work entailed valuations for farmers, especially in the event of subsidence or subsidence of land, especially when the pits were privately owned. Then the farmers used to get him in to estimate the damage, and he was their expert witness.
How many were there in your family?
There was two of us. I'm the eldest one. I'm 77, just. I have a brother, a farmer, who lives at Ogle, near Ponteland, near Newcastle. He is 75. And I had another brother who would have been 76, who was a Roman Catholic priest, who died 4 or 5 years ago. There's three of us.
Was there any tradition of military service in the family?
None whatsoever.
What you presumably had a fairly comfortable upbringing?
Yes.
And what was your education?
My education was, I first of all went to a Catholic we call them elementary schools, in the west end of Newcastle, because this time I think I was about when my parents moved to Newcastle, because his auctioneering valuation business, it was better to have the centre of Newcastle than out at Wylam, a few miles west, because in those days there was no such thing as motor cars. And I went to the elementary school, and then after a few years, I went to St. Cuthbert's Grammar School, which is still in existence at the moment, Benwell, the west end of Newcastle. I was at the original place at Corporation Street in Newcastle, and when I was about 12, I was sent away to the Jesuit school, Mount St. Mary's College, Chesterfield, or Spinkill, Chesterfield, and I stayed there till I was about 17 or 18 when I came back home.
So what kind of education did you get there?
Mixed. Nothing specialised. It was Latin, French, English, Greek, mathematics, absolute general education, and I managed to finally to get about 5 credits or something, which gave me exempt from a trick, and it's purely as an interruption this, but years later, I'm a great lover of poetry, and one of my favourite poets must be Gerard Manley Hopkins. Well, he actually spent a time at Mount St. Mary's College, where he was a school there, about 100 years ago. And there was never a word said about him. And it's only since I left that school, his poetry was presented by Robert Bridges in 1917, because Gerard Manley Hopkins was a Jesuit priest, sent all his poetry to Bridges, and he printed it long after his death, because he died last century, and Bridges printed 1917. Consequently, I was at school in 1924-25, Gerard Manley Hopkins hadn't become famous. Because I'm told now that any boy goes to Mount St. Mary's College of Stonyhurst, they get more and more and more of Gerard Manley Hopkins. But that's my only regret. I had a very happy time there. We played rugby and cricket.
Was the Jesuit side of your education?
Well, it must be, because when you think of it, if we had, say, 20 masters, about 17 were Jesuits. They were either priests or younger priests. What's the word? When they take certain vows, and what happens after they've done part of their training, They then come and teach at the various Jesuit schools. And after that, they're sent away to do their final training, and eventually they come back and teach. In the meantime, they've been to university, got a degree. They eventually come back, and of course what happens then is they still teach. In other words, we had entirely Jesuit, virtually entirely Jesuit masters. We went to church every day. Things have all altered now. And the language, of course, in church was always Latin. And as a consequence, one misses that now. But it was very, very much Jesuit orientated. Now I'm told there are practically no Jesuit priests at all.
Did you, I presume there was no officers' training corps or anything like that there?
Not when I was there. There is now.
Did you have any connection with any boys' organisations, such as the Boy Scouts or anything like that, while you were young?
No, nothing at all. Nothing like that whatsoever.
So what happened when you left? You were there, from 1922 to 1929, roughly speaking.
Yes, I left in presumably July 29, and I joined the Barclays Bank in, September 29. Because in those days, my father had his account at Barclays Bank, Collins Street, Newcastle, and I think he was not unknown there, and it was so easy to get a job. I nearly applied to be a chartered accountant. Well, he said, you better stay in the bank, my father. So I stayed in the bank. I've been there ever since, got my exams. I finished up as a manager.
And you started at the bottom level as a...
Yes, as an ordinary clerk. And worked my way up gradually, having taken my exams. And by this time, I started off in Newcastle branch. In Newcastle, I then moved 2 or 3 years later to Gateshead. This is how the contact came with joining the 9th Battalion down that infantry.
Well, tell me about that. What was this contact?
Well, as point of fact, where I lived in the west end of Newcastle, there were one or two very, very keen youngsters who joined as officers the DLI, 9th DLI. I'm thinking of George Leslie Wood as one in particular, who's now dead. And I was very friendly with he and a few others. I said, why the devil don't you join the DLI at Gateshead? And I did, and I got my... And it accepted me.
How did you just get in? Because you'd had no training. What was the actual mechanism?
Well, the mechanism was simple. You've got to turn up at the mess. We had mess weekly... In those days, there was very little training in the Territorial Army. You had the ordinary... only winter exercises were the odd shooting, which was done in indoor range, which I think it's called, I'm not sure what the size of the bullets are. We had winter months, we trained on the indoor range, and we had no real lectures whatsoever.
But we were talking, how did you actually get in? You had to go to the mess, you say?
No, you had to go to the mess and turn in. Then you had to...
What happened there?
Well, nothing, it was just a social night. Every Tuesday we met there, particularly in the winter months when there's no training at all, not been summer.
And you were invited there as a prospective officer?
Yes, and what happens was you just mixed and the senior officers got to know you. And then, of course, we had this glorious system that eventually the time said, the adjutant said, yes, you can bring March forward for election. Then there's a glorious blackballing system.
Could you tell me how that worked? I haven't heard of that.
Yes, well, what happens is this, you see, it was a thing which now is almost banned or very much frowned upon. What happens, whenever a new officer, a prospective officer, was up for election, we, at a weekly mess night, yea or nay, for his entry into the battalion. And we were given a box was presented to us with two circular holes, one to the left, one to the right. And when you put your hand in the centre, it either went left for yes, or left for no, I think, right for yes or no. I'm not sure which one was which. Therefore, anybody putting their hand in, nobody had any comprehension how he voted, whether for or against. So virtually what happened, if you got in, everybody gave a yes vote. But there's once a case I always remember. There were cases where somebody didn't get in. One black ball or two or three were against them. In that case, the end of it.
Was one black ball enough to put
yes.
them out?
Yes, we had to have agreement or something. Complete acceptance by all. Because one sad case where a charming fellow was put in and somebody didn't like him, he's turned down, and his father was a very, very keen, great war officer, always there. And that created a bit of friction, but the rule never altered. But it's a rule I don't agree with. It should be done openly.
What criteria were people looking for? Well, I mean, you did it yourself later on, I presume.
Well,
you took part in it yourself. What were the criteria?
Well, the criterion was that one realised a war was fairly imminent. This was 1936 or 35, 36, the war was imminent. And a lot of us felt that we ought to do something about this and train ourselves and preparedly for the war, because we'd go in any case we'd want to. And in point of fact, what did happen was, so we started then training.
But you were talking, sticking to the criteria. So you, how did that affect the way you'd vote in assessing someone?
Well, I can't really, it's difficult to say this. You either liked a person, you didn't like a person, or you smelt them or didn't smell them. You know, you can sense people. I mean, after all, in the Territorial Army, and we paid very, very, very little then, and only on training days. And you mixed together, and then the conditions were not easy at times. And you had to make sure that officers whom you vote, prospective officers, were type you'd get on with. Otherwise, there's no point voluntarily giving up a lot of your time for the Territorial Army, unless the officers whom you were in contact with were...
Would it be fair to say that you were looking for officers in the same social class as yourselves?
Inevitably, that must be the case, unfortunately. Because whoever you were, you tended to bring people forward who had similar interests or in a similar situation to you were, or a similar class to you were. That was the tendency to some extent. This is why some territorial battalions, shall we say, in parts of Sussex and certain wealthy areas, certain, I'm thinking of places like in London, of the King's Royal Rifles, and also that other famous one, the territorial one, the one which is in the Honourable Artillery Company, they got the very, very, very best. But we just got an ordinary lot of us. Good lot, ordinary, because we're in an area which is largely industrialised.
Did you ever actually blackball anyone yourself when you
no.
were later on?
No. I think I've always had the view you have no right to blackball anybody unless you know something very, very much against them.
What kind of thing?
Well, it'd have to be somebody, shall we say, if you were... I think you'd have to say somebody who was in business affairs, you for a fact was immoral. I'm talking business-wise. Or his record, as you know, shall we say his family record, and his home record, was a record, a type of person you wouldn't wish under any steps into your own home. But those people hardly ever got to be voted on, because they weren't invited in. They were soon told off, or soon given the word, look here, if you want to bring him in, there's not... You give him a quiet word. People try and make an issue of this. There's no issue at all. Because bear in mind, we're all friendly, and we were just friends together. And then, therefore, anybody we got in was of the same type. But this is why you get some of these county regiments, some of these yeomanry regiments. They were all a different type. But we were a different type. We were different at the end, the Thumb and Fusiliers. But
now, what background were the people that you say there? Were they commercial, normally commercial orientated people, or the background?
Everyone was a commercial. All the officers were commercial. Indeed, some of them, of course, may have joined, and indeed some did, because their parents were in the DLI during the Great War. And they used to still be only members of the mess, and they used to come along regularly. And quite often they joined through their parents. But it was purely a commercial background.
Now, was there any, besides this, the black ball test, and was there anything else that you had to go through before you were accepted as, I think, a second lieutenant in 1936?
Yes, well, no, nothing at all. I mean, what happened was you accepted, and I think what happened then was, presumably the adjutant got in touch with the war office somehow and you gazetted as a second lieutenant. But then, of course, before you got your second pip, you had to attend, we had to in those days, a course at Sandhurst.
I'll come to that
later. I beg your pardon, yes.
As you were, the 9th Battalion, where were they based? Where was the drill hall?
Burt Terrace Gateshead, B-U-R-T, Burt Terrace Gateshead. They built it there for years, and indeed after the war, but at the moment there's no such thing as the DLI now, they're not there now.
What company were you initially put with?
I was initially with C Company at Felling under Clifton Oxley, who will be dead, bound to be, in fact he is. And then I was moved to D Company at Bladen-on-Tyne. And what? I went to the wall, as called that.
Could you describe in outline your training at Felling with C Company? What how many times would you attend? What would you do?
Well, my memory is a bit vague on this matter, but one used to attend once or twice a week for drill nights.
And you'd go to Felling for this?
Yes, Felling.
And they had a drill hall there?
Had drill hall at Felling. And most of the training was done at at Felling. Because it Gateshead, where the headquarters of the company was, you had one company, A Company. You had... I was C Company. I think it was C Company at Felling. And D Company at Bladen. And the other ones, Bladen on Tyne. And the other ones, of course, were the headquarters. But we never mixed, really. Until you went to our annual camp. Then we went to the brigade, the 151 brigade.
And what did you do on a drill night at Felling?
Well, very. Do you know, I don't know. We did very little, you know. We may be training them in small arms firing and things like this, drilling. And but there was no exercise, what's the word? There was no exercise whatsoever on terrain.
No tactical training?
No tactical training whatsoever. The officers had this TUTS, tactical training without troops. TEWT, tactical something without troops. That's known as a TUT. And we used to have that where we used to go out in the hills and the fields of County Down, and we're given an exercise or notes or pre-reading matter, maps of the area and what the battle we're involved with. Then we had to go onto the terrain, and then we had to say exactly what we would do after we'd done a reconnaissance of the area. Then give our view to the adjutant or the CO. And we'd all have to do this. And so our only training really was this tactical exercise without troops. But we had to work on this. None of us liked it very much because it worked jolly hard. But still.
What was the hardness of it? What were you doing that was difficult?
Well, the hardness was because you're giving these all these notes, preliminary notes about a campaign that shall we say in the Thumberland what's the word I'm thinking about? Thumberland and Durham were the greatest of enemies, say, and we're separated by the River Tyne. And we said, to hell with those bloody bastards, we're going to... This sort of thing, you know. This was not the case, but that's the view we had to get inside ourselves. We were probably attacking across the Tyne, they were attacking this way. And we were giving, that view. Then we had to give our reply in verbally to the adjutant. And then we kept on moving round in this terrain, you see. We had these reconnaissances. Really, it was an exercise, but a lot of work was done, but without any troops or any training whatsoever.
So you'd just be working out plans of reconnaissance and attack?
That's right, yes, and defence.
And would umpires be interpreting what was happening as a result, or...?
Yes, because what we had to do was, yes, we had to get, each one of us had separately to give an opinion what would happen, what we would do, under the given circumstances. Then the adjutant or some other senior officer, who knew the final answer, or they must have worked out some answer. It's rather like that famous story, The Defence of Duffer's Drift. That's a classic story. But that's what...
Mm-hmm. Do you want to tell that? What?
No, I can't remember what happened was... I think that it comes in... It's an absolute classic story, The Defence of Duffer's Drift. I think Duffer's Drift was some kraal or something in South Africa. But what happened was, whatever he did, well, he had a dream. Whatever he did was wrong. But the wrongest thing of all was he had a brilliant victory. In other words, useless, that through his uselessness, he did the correct thing. That's the defence of Duffer's Drift. I've never forgotten that.
So you had these twos. How were you actually trained before you went for your PIP, your second PIP? How were you actually trained yourself as a soldier? Who told you how to behave? And
adjutant. Mainly governed by the adjutant. But not a lot of training was done.
What sort of things did you have to learn as an officer? Were you expected to have a grasp of military law or the art of command or... small arms weapons, any of that, drill?
Well, no, you had to, for instance, none of us knew anything about small arm weapons. You picked all this up, and you went through the own training yourself with the, because we had a permanent staff of CSM and RSM and certain sergeants who were skilled in this sort of thing, and we actually used to take these tests ourselves and learn the arms, the guns and the rifle drill and use of the weapons from them.
You were taught by the senior NCOs as
the senior NCOs who were attached to the battalion as regulars.
And they taught you the same sort of things that they teach the other
yes,
ranks?
Yes, exactly, because we have no right to instruct anybody or anything about unless we did the work ourselves. We had to do exactly what they did. Mm-hmm.
What would you say your role was as a junior second lieutenant? Did you have any idea of what it was at the time?
No, very vaguely. It was given by your company commander, really, you know. And then you'd meet occasionally bear in mind the summer months. We came to shooting out at Whitburn. That's where our range was there. And occasionally you'd bust the company somewhere. But most of the thing was done in the drill hall. And we were ill-prepared when war broke out for any war, like most people were.
How did you get on with your fellow officers then? Do you remember any of them, any particular characters amongst them, or their senior NCOs?
No, I can't recall very well. And that's, no, I can't remember anybody. I don't think we produced...
What about your company commander? What was he like?
Well, Camerslight was all right. He was in the coal trade. And then... he was quite all right. Pleasant fellow. I knew him. He worked on the quayside. And I was in Barker's Bank on the quayside as well. I knew he was very pleasant. But there's no real characters. And when we went to Failing, I don't know who the commander there, I think, was Campbell Slight. But it doesn't really matter because I can't recall these very much. And there's no what I call outstanding characters.
How did you get on with the men as a second left in your early days?
I think very well.
What did you think of them? What did they think of you, do you think?
Well, I don't know what they thought, but it's difficult to say. I'll never know this. But bear in mind, I haven't been born and bred on the banks of the Tyne, on Tyneside, and those at Felling were the same. And we had a large number, of course, of coal mining in our... who, of course, eventually, as you know, they were... when they went abroad at the outbreak of war, they were sent back to this country because they had reserved occupation. Indeed, I always remember those cases, Felling in particular. Every year we had to have a shoot, had to qualify in small arms fire, you see. It was mainly done on indoor range. I forget it's 0.22 or so. Anyway, it's a 0.22 bullet. And what happened, we ourselves had to do it in front of the men. and so had they. But many, many, many a time. And we had to pass. And frankly, we did. But many of those people, troops, could never pass because they came straight from the pits and the eyes were full of coal dust. Full of coal dust. And they come straight from jolly hard work underground. And shall we say, they were treated not harshly. But in point of fact, they all came back. When they went abroad, they all came back to this country. But we had to train with them, yes, that sort of thing.
Now, you joined in 1936. What was your first summer camp? Did you have a summer camp?
Yes, we went to... That's where I first came in. I think it's one of the first times I ever met Charles Burden Taylor. Because he was the 8th Battalion, we were the 9th, and the other battalion was the 6th Battalion, who were based in Bishop Auckland and Barnet Castle. And at summer camp, we all met as a brigade. And I think one we went to was Marsk-on-Sea, which is near Redcar in northern Yorkshire. But then we did meet and mix socially quite a lot.
What did you think of the other battalions? Was there an easy relationship between...
The 8th Battalion, which is based on Durham, a tremendous relationship. The 6th Battalion, no. They were a bit... We thought, they're very, very toffee-nosed. They thought they're very, very toffee-nosed. They thought they're better than anybody else. But don't worry, we used to deal with that. In camp, I was once at camp. We soon sort this lot out. So when they were having a mess night one night, we quietly went around and just loosed all the guy ropes and hoped everything collapsed on top of them. We did stupid things like this. But anyway, we did stupid things like this.
Was it genuine bad feeling or sort of half-jokey bad feeling, do you think, between the 8th and the 6th?
No, I think the question one didn't get on with them too well. And the 8th Battalion, the Durham one, didn't either, because the 9th and the 8th got them very well together, you see.
What actual training were you doing at camp?
Well, I'm trying to think about it when at camp. Well, we had exercise, mainly exercise in the field. And I think I'm right in saying no live ammunition at all. And then we had attached troops like the engineers in the division, in the brigade, you see, and the attached engineers and the Oh dear, what are the other ones called again? The engineers.
Doesn't matter.
No, we're attached troops. And the artillery, of course. I think we were the 74th Field Artillery, South Shields. They were the attached artillery with us, you see. And we used to all be in there together. And we used to simulate action, you see. That's the point. But I can't, I'm a bit vague about this. But I think nothing to what it is now.
Were you enjoying the territorial training? Because it was voluntary. Did you enjoy being a territorial? Were you proud?
Well, I think one quite enjoyed, or very much enjoyed the discipline. And also, I think one was always impressed. In those days, the British Army had a great lot of first-class regular army officers, absolutely straight as dime. I mean, some hadn't got any bloody brains, but the odd one or two were very, very good. But men you could trust implicitly, and it's a pleasure to work with them. And you trained yourself this way, you see. It's a way of you utilising your free time, social time, you see, mixing people like this. And it was very enjoyable, because an awful lot of backfall of... We got friendly with these people, we used to meet them socially, we used to go to the Army, Navy and the Military Ball in Newcastle, or certain regimental dinners and balls and things. So we had a very, very good social life. In fact, social life is probably more than the training life. But there again, don't worry.
Now, you said you went on a course to get your second PIP, but that was in 1938, I think, you told me.
I'm guessing... I think we got our second PIP after 2 years or 3 years. I'm not sure which it is. I'm not sure it's 2 or 3 years.
Oh. And where did you go for that?
Sandhurst, the RMC at Sandhurst. And you had to pass out. And if you passed out, you got your second PIP. And that was a tremendous experience. I always remember that.
What?
Mainly drilling by these guardsmen. They really put us through it. Especially about 7 o'clock in the morning when we've been out most of the night. But no, we are very, very regular army instructors. And instructors, I'm sure, in rifle drill and marching, things like this. And really put us through it. And I can't remember exactly what's happened, sir. You're bloody useless, sir! Listen to me, sir! You know the way to go on. This is it. And we never forgot those days. We worked bloody hard, and the trainers are. We were mainly training in marching, drilling, and small arm fire, but no exercise in the field, as far as I remember. But it's a great, great experience being the RMC Sandhurst.
So you passed that?
Well, yes, obviously, because I got my second PIP, yes.
And you're now a lieutenant. Did you have any specialisation within the battalion? Or were you just an infantry?
I was purely infantry. You had the odd one who... his bent was signals, and of course he went to the signally office, things like this. But I'm just the ordinary infantryman. I had no specialisation. If you had, I think you'd have probably pushed to another TA battalion who could use your specialisation. I'm thinking of the Royal Engineers in particular, and even the Royal Artillery.
Now, you moved, it was sometime around 38-ish, around there, that you switched to D Company.
Yes.
At Hebburn, was it?
No, D Company was at Bladen. That's right. I've started off with C Company at Felling. The headquarters group was at Gateshead, and D Company was at Bladen-on-Tyne, which is west of Gateshead, near getting in the way, very near where I was born at Wylam.
Were there any differences between the two companies that you noticed? Did they have their regional characteristics within the battalion, or were they pretty well the same?
No, because they were, when you think of it, Felling was only... Felling actually is in Gateshead. It's only about 3 miles east of it. Whereas Bladen is only about 4 miles west. So I'd say you can't evade it. Very, very few characteristics.
The training, as war got nearer, did the pace of training increase?
Yes, because all the territorial battalions were doubled up. And I remember we doubled up and we became the Tyneside Scottish, our doubled up regiment.
And the 12th. Or would have been.
Well, we're up now, yeah, the 9th, 6th, 8th, and 9th. It'd be 10th, 11th, and 12th. Or the 11th, 12th, and 13th. See, the 6th had a second line, the 8th had a second line, and we had one. Now, our second line was called the Tyneside Scottish, because there used to be a Tyneside Scottish in the Great War, and they wanted to revive this. And they were attached, in many respects, to the Black Watch. And indeed, people to this day still go to the dinner there at Perth.